This is Karen Brewster, and today is June 7th, 2024, and I am here with Terry O'Sullivan, and he is in Scottsdale, Arizona, and I am in Fairbanks, Alaska, and we're doing this interview by Zoom, and it's an interview for the Iditarod National Historic Trail Project Jukebox. So thank you, Terry, for making this happen this morning. I know the technology is a little extra complicated this way.
Yeah.
But we do the best we can.
Oh, this side too. I'm glad we connected.
Yes. As you know, we've gone back and forth with the questions and what we're going to talk about today. So why don't we just get started with a little bit of background about yourself before we get into your role with the Iditarod Trail.
Sure. I was born in 1948 in a little place called Santerra Valley, very orchard type town and stuff, very quiet. They used to call it Valley of the Heart's Delight because of the all the fruit orchards. But now, and I was raised in Cupertino, but now they call it Silicon Valley. It's the home of Apple computers, and it's whole different from where I grew up, but that's where I started. I went to Humboldt State College, graduated in 1970, Natural Resource Management. And from there I started, while I was going to college, I started working for the Forest Service in Oregon as a firefighter. And I lived in a little guard station on the Wyneema National Forest and worked that for three seasons and was headquarters fireman at the Ranger District. I started 69 as a firefighter. 1973, I transferred up the Olympic National Forest where I was recreation assistant on the Hood Sport Ranger District and taking care of campgrounds, trails, and that sort of thing there. Must have been 1976, I took a trip up to Alaska to visit a friend who was working for the BLM in Fairbanks. And while I was there, I noticed a job announcement for an outdoor recreation planner up in Fairbanks. I heard that was coming up. And so when the job opened, I went ahead and put in for it, and I was selected for that position. So I transferred agencies in May of 1977 and started work on the Yukon resource area. And it was pretty much that was pretty much about a third of the whole state of Alaska, but primarily the pipeline corridor was the big issue there. I arrived in Alaska about the time the oil hit Valdez. So it was kind of still a bit of a wild town then and there, but we worked that really, really enjoyed working there. While there, about 1979, so it was only a few years, 77, about 3 years later, there was the designation of the National Trail in 78, so right after I got there. But in 1979, they started up a project team, and I had put in for that job, and I was able to transfer from Fairbanks down to Anchorage to start working on the project team. So that's kind of a quick how I got there, how I got to Alaska. And yeah. I spent 13 years there after that.
Okay. So when you started with the Iditarod Trail project team, and then you moved into other parts of working on the trail and the trail administrator, and that was for a total of 13 years?
Well, I think the project team, we had about two and a half years from when from that 79 to the end of probably September of 81 to that the we were funded for the project team. That's when we got the it turned out to be all the draft documents done by that time. And then in 82, I was sort of the last man standing there. So I assumed the trail administrator role. And then we were able to work with the state. Of course, the whole premise by that time was cooperative management. So we were working closely with Alaska State Parks. So under an Intergovernmental Personnel Act assignment, I actually grabbed my files and everything, and I set up office in Alaska State Parks and worked with them for another two years, and until funding on both sides kind of ran out to support that effort. But it was really interesting working in the state park environment. Because it was, we call it the Joint State Federal Trails Office, and I not only Iditarod, but worked on a lot of state trail inventories and projects and issues and that sort of thing. And it was a really good group of people to work with. I worked primarily with a gentleman called Ron Crenshaw, and he was a good partner there. He helped me move my file cabinet over. I remember that day in the back of the pickup. I think the ink wasn't dry in the IP, because I knew it. Well, and I think the managers knew there. If I was back in just BLM, it would be kind of BLM and other duties assigned. But I was able to concentrate just on trails for that amount of time. At the end of that process, another couple of years, funding kind of dried up, and then it was back to the Anchorage District Office across town, and I was assigned to the McGrath Resource Area, and that was the resource area that managed the majority of the Iditarod Trail that was on BLM land. So that was the logical place for me to land. A few years later, I put in for the Anchorage District Office rec planner, so one step up, and Iditarod followed me there. But all that time was considered the go-to trail manager, because I knew more about, as far as from the federal BLM standpoint, I knew more about all the ins and outs of the plan and the people and stuff right there. A little later, I've got some dates here, a little down, so I didn't think was promoted to the state lead for recreation for BLM Alaska. And I worked that for about 3 years until about 1990, I believe. And then I transferred to down to be the state lead for recreation in Arizona. So it was a kind of a lateral position, same position, different state, different issues and stuff. And I worked pretty much on that until I retired, although I did a couple of years right at the end assigned to the Washington office working on the recreation management information system for the Bureau. So in a nutshell, that was my path to get me here to Scottsdale, Arizona.
And when did you retire?
I retired in 2003. Okay. So I was retired 5 days after I was eligible, and grabbed my banjo and my suitcase and joined my wife, who was teaching in England at one of the universities there. So she says, this is a very small cottage. You can't bring much, but you can bring your banjo.
You're a very understanding wife.
Oh, she is. Oh, believe me.
All right. Well, that's a great precursor to getting us to your role with the Iditarod Trail. So do you want to start with, back in 1978, 79, and what was going on and your role?
Yeah, and the thing I was kind of reflecting on just even this morning, that we have to remember where the Bureau was in 1978, 79. They had just passed the Federal Land Management and Policy Act, Federal Land Policy and Management Act, FLTMA, in 76. and the designation of the trail came on there. So the whole role of the Bureau changed in that, and it certainly didn't change overnight. I mean, in 1975, we were still worried about calibrating, and not that we didn't, but strictly disposing of land, transferring land to states, grazing, mining, and that sort of thing. And recreation was happened because we had still had some wonderful recreation values throughout the country, but it was never emphasized. Then with FLTMA, all of a sudden it became kind of management, protection, and enhancement, and development. So it really went from more of the multiple use agency, more in line with what the Forest Service mandate was at that time. But again, that didn't happen overnight. So then when the project office, which was formed in 79, really just picked up where the Bureau of Outdoor Recreation left off on the Gold Rush study. The Iditarod Trail and other Gold Rush trails, I think it was the report was, and that's something that Backcourt Show, right. Well, I think you want to worked on, and so there was a kind of a handoff from one interior agency to the other of that. So we, grabbed everything that they had, which was primarily their one booklet that showed the trails that they identified that were designated. And that was really our starting point for where we began. In 79, the state recreation lead had been Kerry Brown, and he took, matter of fact, we were on a river trip on the 40 Mile River, big kind of show me trip with the Washington folks, and that's when I first heard about the National Trail Project team there, and I said, I really want to be on that and put in for it, and was able to. But he assembled the team with me as kind of the project planner, Steve Peterson, which is a historic architect, Bob Spooty, who worked for the National Park Service, he was our historian, and we had quite a few other temporaries and work study students and stuff. We had a little, quite a little group of people that, we just got together and say, well, what do we do now? We've never done this before. My role in the project planner, I was sort of the cog in the middle that kind of had to bring. Kerry kind of directed what needed to be done, and we all, through discussions through all of us, but he directed it, and I was sort of the one that kind of took all the information in and started pulling the volume one, volume two, the comprehensive plan together. I put the pieces together and participated in some of the different activities and stuff. And but it was really a fun interagency group of people. I mean, they're all, it was all great doing that. So that's how we kind of got together.
Do you know how the different people were selected?
I'm not sure on that. I'd recommend, I can give you a contact for Kerry Brown. Yeah. I'm sure he would be happy to talk about that thing. I just know when I got there, we were a team and we took off running.
Okay. Yeah, when you look at the list of who all was on there, you say, Bob Spooty, Steve Peterson, you,
Gene Schweringen. Patty Friend, which was the Iditarod Musher, helped us for a while. It was a good group of people. And that's it was just a matter of bringing all those pieces together and trying to get a plan in the time frame, because it was a pretty tight time frame. I think it was, we were supposed to have it by the end, everything completed by the end of 1981, I believe.
Yeah. And what, for people who don't know what, this is a comprehensive management plan for the trail. So what goes into that? How do you know what to talk about? What's the purpose?
It's obviously really tie down the trail. I mean, it was the maps in the VOR report were dotted lines on a single page, and he had to do that. Where we left off, it was the...
So the purpose of the plan.
I think the National Trails Act kind of outlined what should be in a comprehensive plan, and a lot of it is, you know, identifying the trail, rights of ways, interpretation, who's involved and everything. And at that time, at the same time, we were working on the country, Park Service Park Service work on the Oregon Trail and the Mormon Pioneer Trail. So we had meetings with those folks down in Denver just to kind of compare notes and to, you know, share information and get an idea of what made up the plan. So put the pieces together and, you know, based on the National Trail System Act, which called for it, and coordination with the Park Service on what they had done and were doing, is kind of how we came up with the outline of the plan.
And so let's see. So what exactly went into the plan? What, you know, maybe summarize that outline.
Well, I think the first probably at least half a year was just gathering information on the historic sites, old trail maps, old photographs. We did the oral history part. We hired a gentleman by the name of Tom Beck, who went out to the different villages and tried to get some of the old timers who we knew weren't going to be around forever to talk about their experiences on there. And I was actually happy after you asked me to be on this to find out that those things are available online. That was very exciting for me to see what is available to the public. So as far as the outline, I think, you know, we're all your planners and stuff used to doing different things. I think it's just put it together and came up with the outline that's in the thing. And tell you the truth, I can't remember. I don't have a copy of the only one from me to do. But if you went down, look at that. That's what came in, and I think that's pretty standard. Even if you look at the Park Service and what they've done with the like the Oregon Trail and stuff. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's just the public access, public information, protection of properties, public use of the trail, and gathering the information and keeping it one place, which I'm glad it seems to be.
That management plan is still out there. I don't know how much they're following. It hasn't been updated, and as you say, you did the draft. It was a draft. I don't know that there's ever been a final one.
Yes, there was. There was.
Oh, there was a final one.
Yeah, about 86.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
The draft was kind of interesting. We, under that tight deadline, get that thing done in 2 years. We came up with the resource, the volume 2, the resource inventory of everything that we had found and documented and where it ended up. And volume 1, and we started releasing that to the thing. I think there's probably a few copies of that original 81 one out, and went back to Washington, D.C. to present it to the higher-ups there in the Bureau. And you got to remember, in 1981, the president was Ronald Reagan, and we were sort of in we went into an austere period, and again, with kind of a administration that didn't really want to spend too much money on the federal government lands, and with FLTMA's, with the change in the Bureau's whole thing, we were basically told it was too aggressive and we couldn't release any more copies of that. But that was the vision, and again, that was part of the, you know, working with what the other National Historic Trails managed by the Park Service, that was sort of their, you know, you do have national trail offices and multiple staff and everything, but, you know, we were a Bureau was the poor sister of the Department of Interior agencies that the higher ups weren't as enthused about what we had proposed, and quite honestly, there wouldn't have been money to do it anyway, just because the budgets were really, really tight. And that's part of what led to me teaming up with the state and the joint state federal state trail office, because we could combine budgets and get some stuff done. It was a very productive time.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that the Park Service does a lot of this trail administration in other places. Why was BLM given responsibility for the Iditarod Trail instead of the Park Service?
Well, because I think the bureau had land involved in it. We were managing, before the national trails, we were managing sections of the trail, and we were an agency that set up Park Service. So of course they're well represented in Alaska. They didn't have any piece of the action there. And I think it was, again, after we had gone, I think the congressman actually kind of wanted us to kind of have a little bit of the action and stuff. So, I'm glad it happened that way, because it was a good experience. But if had gone to the Park Service, who knows what the reception as far as supplying budgets and staff would have been. No, I don't know. That's an interesting thought.
Yeah. Well, also, the interesting thought I haven't thought about before until listening to you is the impact of the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, which came after you started all this. You know, that was in 81, 82.
Yeah.
And did that...
They had their hands full.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and you're right that none of the, in 78, 79, 80, the Park Service didn't have as much jurisdiction in Alaska. And then afterwards, they were so overwhelmed with ANILCA that it does make sense that BLM had them.
And it's kind of funny, I mentioned earlier that we started work for the BLM at the Yukon Resource Area. We managed part of the state. That was pre-ANILCA. And so, yeah, we had management of all those areas, you know, and on thin staff and stuff like that. And then when ANILCA came in, and I'd forgotten about the sequence of that, but you're absolutely right. It was just it all changed very, very quick.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they had enough to worry about. Probably still do.
Yes. Well, this is the first I've heard of this joint state federal trails office. I know there was a joint pipeline office for a period, the pipeline corridor and all that, but I'm curious to hear more about this joint trails office.
Well, it was just a matter of I went on. It was basically me and Ron Crenshaw situated at state parks and to work on trail issues, and it was just a matter of the funding wasn't there for much Iditarod or other work, and with the plan having been at least I think approved at that time and stuff, the state was anxious to kind of get they were very up on the Iditarod Trail, and especially around north of Connect through Susitna Valley and stuff. They wanted to get some of their rights of ways established and stuff. So with me coming over there, I helped them identify the trails and get the paperwork done to get some of those trails tied down and stuff. So it was instead of a one-man operation, it was sort of a two-man operation, but it was very, very effective, because it worked with all the other state park people and the lands office and stuff. And they were very, very good hosts to me being there. It was a unique opportunity for a federal employee to work in the state government, because I notice how things happened at different speeds, federal government versus state office, you know, or the state parks. It was neat.
So did it work faster on the state versus the federal?
Yeah, Well, things happen. You know, state legislature says something, and it gets done next week. A lot of times, or very quickly, and stuff. And where everything's right there, where the bureau is. You know, you got your 2-year budget process, and this and that, and everything. Yeah. So it's from a coordination standpoint, it was a good place to be at that point.
Mm-hmm. So you had mentioned that the initial draft plan, you kind of got pushed back on that and wasn't right. quite acceptable. So did you make changes to it? And then what happened to get it to the final?
Yeah, well, we did. We were given, said there was a lot of things in there that like projected budgets for the different agencies. And they said, well, no, that bureau can't be telling other agencies what they ought to be budgeting. And some of the And I think the scope of the National Trail Office versus a one-person administrator and stuff, I can't remember all the stuff, but yeah, we pretty much, and then that was after the team disassembled, I guess, or faded out and stuff. I still had to make those changes in the draft and kind of get those, start getting those through there to make it acceptable so that they would sign up there, sign off on the plan. So, yeah, but we finally got there. I think it was 86 finally got the approval. I think one of the reasons it went there, I think the congressman kept getting letters, Don Young and Frank Murkowski and Ted Stevens, they kept getting, what happened that I did, or I only come from Alaska. And I think I was looking through one of my old notes and stuff in a newspaper interview and said, I think they got tired of answering those letters. So we got the funding and the approval to get that done.
Okay. So who approves it in the end? It was upper levels of BLM administration?
Secretary of Interior. It's the Secretary's trail. So one of the assistant secretaries signed off. I think it might have been Odell at that time. I can't remember.
Okay, I just didn't know yet. It was only BLM that had to approve it. The other agencies represented on that team didn't need to get it approved.
No, they just had to. We had to cooperate with them and show that we had cooperated with them and stuff. And it was Secretary of Interior.
Okay.
Who was doing that for us, Fish Wildlife Service and all, and Forest Service was meaningful to it.
Well, yeah, the Oral History Project that you mentioned, that was to document some of the historic uses of the trail, right?
Yes. I think Tom was able to go out and get, I think, about 20 different interviews or so. I forget how many were out there, but that was a good, and the fact that they survived. One of the things I did before I left the trail administrator position, I got those tapes over to the Alaska across the street to the historical museum, because I was afraid they get lost.
Yeah, well, it's great. We have copies here at the Rasmussen Library Oral History Collection, and then ARLIS is what you're the.
Yeah.
What is it? Alaska Resources Library. I can't remember what it stands for. But they're the ones who digitized them and put them online.
Oh, that was wonderful. That was very, very thrilling to see they still existed.
Yes, so thanks to you. And then there's transcripts as well. Sort of there's a report that was produced, a hard copy report that we have in our library.
Yeah. I think it was Steve Peterson and Bob Spoody that I noticed you were asking whose idea was that. I'm sure it was the historians that said, yeah, we got to get these guys. And they found Tom who actually did it. And I think we went out on a couple with him, but he was the primary interviewer and had his system down. But it was neat.
Yeah, it was a great idea because, those guys aren't there anymore. And I guess the Bureau of Recreation survey that you mentioned, the BOR report, they didn't go talk to people. They were doing it sort of the land use part, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, it was the initial study to see if it was worthy or not and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a good effort, and I'm glad it survived.
Yeah. And I think not so common thing to do in a comprehensive management plan.
Yeah. Well, because it was a historic property, and we were looking at historic resources, we're better than, first person knowledge on that. Mm-hmm. And the other parts of it too is I can't remember the couple Parks Service guys. I don't think we're listed anything I found. They went out and did HABS drawings of things like Rhone River Roadhouse and the existing structures and a lot of them that were getting ready to fall in there. And I think I'm not sure those records ended up in public domain, but I'm sure they're somewhere and stuff. But just to document these ones that 40 years later that they might not even need to be there or worse condition, but at least to document the structural condition of them at the time. And that was really valuable. They worked one season with us to do that.
And they were for the Park Service?
Park Service, yeah.
Yeah, Steve Peterson might know about it. That was one of my questions is, what was out there on the trail at the time? Was there still any physical evidence and whether structures or archaeology and how was that documented?
A lot of the old roadhouse remains left. Rhone River was probably the one that was in the best condition and still being used periodically. And then the volume two listed all those properties that were there. And I think that the condition and the recommendations of what should be done with them, whether they should be maintained or, stabilized and what or just, but we just needed to document where they were in 1881.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I haven't seen volume two.
It's actually on the Arliss.
Is it? Thing I found. Okay.
Yeah. For years, I had all those documents and stuff. I was cleaning out. Probably just 6 months ago, I donated to one of the libraries here, and stuff. I had the old BOR report, the yellow lit one, and mm-hmm. that, and volume one, volume two, and stuff. And I cleaned. I was there going to see this stuff, and I thought it was moving to England. There, so I was cleaning out things and trying to get them like donated to a library, but then when you call, I go, I wish I had that stuff. I had enough to.
I'm glad that Arliss has the volume two. Our library only has volume one, and we have the BOR report. But since I only saw volume one, I wondered, was there ever a volume two done? So you've now answered that.
And I was strictly called resource inventories and stuff, and a very good, it's nice showing the trails that we looked at, and it's just a wealth of information. I went through it last night, and I just stumbled onto it myself when I found Arliss and stuff, and so I recommend you scan that. There's a lot of good info.
Yeah. So the other question is, since the trail was out of use for so long, how did you guys mark the route? How did you figure that out?
We, from the planning team, we didn't mark it. So you got to remember, BLM had two roles here, the trail administrator and then the management of it. And it wasn't just a single trail, it was a trail network all there. So what the project team did is we, through the research of finding old maps, going back to Goodwin's study of 1908 and old USGS maps and anywhere we could find a record, we refined the any route that we could on there. So what we did is just kind of tried to tie down to the best we could where the trail was. In some cases, the trail is down the middle of the Yukon River. during the winter time. Yeah, so that was pretty easy. The BLM had a big stretch across the Farewell Burn from Rum River up to McGrath. That was pretty easy to do. And of course, the Iditarod Trail Committee had been marking the trail for their two different race routes. So parts of those the trail network was already there. I think most of the BLM management, so the coordination role, I was sort of the well, I was the go-to guy for information. So going through some of my old files and stuff, I get contact by the Matsu Borough, the City of Nome, State Lands Department and stuff. When they're working on a project, say, okay, I did a rock trail here. What does it mean to us? So I'd go talk to them or document, it's here. As best we know, our recommendation was this. There's this historic property there, and it's their land. It's not the federal land in those cases, and they would take that information, and we're actually pretty good about it. But, you know, I think Alaskans are pretty protective of the Iditarod and anything associated with that. So that was sort of my role in the trail management role. I think a lot of the actual on the ground management, I didn't go out and mark trails or anything there. I was more of the public information guy. But I think subsequent trail administrators / managers, which that role became, started working on the public use sites and stuff like over with the Caltag Portage and that sort of stuff. And it kind of followed a little bit of that. So those sorts of management things. But it wasn't, mine was coordinator, source of information. I did rock guru, I guess.
Well, and in that role, did you collaborate with the Iditarod Trail Advisory Council?
Oh, yes. Yeah, we did. At any, both formally and informally, because there was a, I'd forgotten there was sort of a break in the action with the advisory council. The first one was appointed in 1991, right before we released the first draft and got their input on that. And then I can remember 3-4 meetings in there, but then even informally talking to Joe Rennington and Dan Seavey and Dick Mackey and this sort of thing, there was different issues that would come up. So we did work with them there. Then there was, at the end of the first term, I can't remember quite the dates on that, but then the Bureau was kind of dragging their feet on, or the Secretary of the Bureau, whoever, on reappointing the committee there. But again, yeah, you know, the coordination kept happening, maybe not in a formal thing. I'd be really interested to see what the meeting notes from any advisory council meetings were. I didn't have any of those and stuff, so I can't remember all the things. But I remember 3 or 4 meetings that we had with them and talk about different issues.
Yeah, and I can't remember if they were formed right at the beginning with the historic trail designation, or did they come later?
Pretty close. A little bit later, I think. I think they came about the time the project team. I have 81.
Okay.
In fact, I have this one book that says advisory council appointed January 14th, 1981 by the Secretary of the Interior.
Okay.
So that was the first one. So that was a little bit after, but that's it. So we had been working since 79 to get something for them to advise on.
Okay. Yikes.
And so they were reviewing that draft that didn't see the light of day or too much light. And we got input from them. It was a really, really good group of people to work with.
Okay. So they didn't help put together the plan. They reviewed it and made comment.
They reviewed it and stuff. Now, all the writing was done by us.
Right. Okay.
And pulling it together. Yeah.
Okay.
So, which advisory, that was their role. And they had other things to do, like run races and businesses and cities and stuff like that.
Well, there's the Iditarod Trail Committee, which you mentioned, who, you know, put on the race. And, you know, Joe Reddington and Dick Mackey marking the trail for the racing. But then the advisory council was for the actual trail. And it's now called the Iditarod Historic Trail Alliance. They changed their name. So they kind of different roles. Mm-hmm. And I just didn't know, how BLM worked with and coordinated with the council. And did the council come to you and say, we'd like BLM to do this, this, and this, or?
Well, probably in the meetings and stuff that we had meetings. I think they were trying to hit for 2 a year during that critical period where we were writing it and stuff. And as I recall, any issue they had before the meeting would get on the agenda to be dealt with and stuff. I was long gone before the Trail Alliance got formed, and I didn't actually realize that there was no advisory council there, but it makes perfect sense that that's what happened, you know.
Yeah, well, I think they play the same role. They just changed their name. As you say, they were advising on the plan and the early implementation, and now they're like the Friends of the Trail group.
Yeah, but I don't think they're appointed by the Secretary of Interior.
No.
Their own group, but they're still working with BLM. I mean, which is great. That's the whole thing of the cooperative management of the trails. That makes perfect sense, and probably easier because the charter doesn't run out of time and stuff. The other group I wanted to really mention too is the Iditarod Trailblazers.
Yeah, great. Thank you.
So early on, even in that first draft, it was and they had come to us that there was. Dan Seavey down Seward and Joe Rankin and Connect, especially, I'm not sure which came first, but they came with the idea what we need is these individual volunteer trail groups to take care of segments of the trail. And that was really, really a neat thing, especially down Seward. I'm a lifetime member of the Seward Iditarod Trailblazers. I was at the first meeting and paid my lifetime fee at that time, so I still get in there. So I really keep track of what's happening down there, and have a little message with Dan Stevie now and again, and stuff. In Kinnick, Joe, I think, was having a hard time getting volunteers for that part of it because Kinnick was center of all things Iditarod, and I'm not sure if that volunteer group ever took off as far as maintaining that, but with the Iditarod Trail Committee there, they probably getting things done they wanted to get done, but I think the Iditarod Trailblazers down Seward has been just a huge success, just huge, and that was the concept. I'm not sure how many chapters there are now along the trail, but I think that was really a model volunteer cooperative effort there. It's just neat.
So they would go out and maintain the trail. That was the idea.
Yeah.
Brush it out. And I think there might've been one out of Nome.
I wouldn't be surprised. They were basically trail maintenance and enhancement. And I know down in Seward, they do a lot of interpretation and stuff.
Yeah, I was wondering if there was one out of McGrath, too, as you said, you know, that was a more used section of trail, and people are out there breaking trail and clearing brush. I don't know if McGrath had one, or currently it has one.
Yeah, it was just the two were in contention when I was there,
okay.
And the concept still stays, I guess.
Yeah, well, I know Dick Mackey and Joe did projects to brush out and mark the trail out of Kinnick up to Susitna Station and up in that area. So I know at least those guys did that. I don't know if other people worked on other sections.
Yeah. Yeah, that was pretty much in support of the race trail, but of course that keeps the historic route open and stuff. So it's all hand in glove. It's all good.
Right, and then the southern portion, as you say, from Seward, you know, up through Eagle River and all that section, that's Forest Service, and that has more recently become a focus. I think during your period, that probably wasn't really happening then, was it?
Well, the trail is there, but as far as highlighting the National Historic Trail aspect, I got a little side story. My wife and I, Anne Marie, were married up at Crow Pass.
Oh, fun.
2001. Yeah, we hiked up and had one of our friends was marriage commissioner, and we were dropped our packs and got married up at Crow Pass.
And then did you keep going, or did you...
Went down. We just got there. We were visiting Alaska, and then we just our honeymoon was touring Alaska.
Great.
That stuff. So
yeah, I've never hiked that trail. So, but I do know when you go down the other side, you have to cross the river.
Yeah, we did. I never made it from a little bit from each end, and married up the Crow Pass. But
that's great. One thing more on the plan before we move into, you know, what you did as administrator is you kind of touched on it, but there are a lot of things mentioned in that plan that it looks like never happened. Like there was this whole concept of interpretive exhibits, and there were historic photos in Nome that were going to be inventoried or something. And at least the exhibits, I don't think really happened. And so why did some things happen and others didn't?
Well, I think those may have been part of the original concept of the 81 draft. And I think we discovered that level of involvement and that amount of money there wasn't in the works during the early 80s. So the decision is, well, if you don't fund it, you know, it won't be done. So I can't tell you exactly who, why, when, or what, but it's just the money wasn't there is the bottom line.
Okay.
To do that.
So, so you can say in a plan, it would be great, we want to do A, B, and C, but then you have to go get the money separately.
Yeah.
And if the money's not there.
And I'm not sure which plan. It was the 86 plan that still had that in it.
I don't remember.
I think you must have a copy of that 81 plan, which I know there were copies around that had. That was part of that whole National Trail Office concept to have a staff and do all these things and have the money rolling in. And when that was shot down, it was we're lucky to get funding for one person. And I'm pretty sure the trail administrator has other duties as assigned even today, you know.
Yeah.
So I did Rod's part of their remit, but I'm just guessing that's the case. So
yeah, well that explains it. That you write a just because you put something in a plan doesn't mean you have the money to do it. It's the if we had all the money in the world, we'd like these things to happen.
Yeah, and. And if it's in a draft plan that does get approved, it really doesn't get
approved. Yeah, that's true. Okay, so you said you moved into the role as administrator. So let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, and what that was kind of like the source, and kind of touched on a little bit, a source of information as far as anything to do with Iditarod, pretty much. The historic trail, I was the contact person. So like I mentioned, if there's someone working on a right of way or a road realignment or different things, they come in. And plus also I was sort of on the speaking tour too. I went to schools, chamber of commerce meetings, different city meetings, went down to Seward, I think, once, and so just went around to give people to tell them, this is what the Iditarod is, and this is what we're doing, and and this is how you get involved type of thing. So I did a lot of that, wrote different articles for different papers. And I was the interview person when the papers wanted something about happening on the Iditarod. Got a couple of those and stuff. So coordinator was, I wasn't so much on the trail clearing brush. I was there fielding questions and providing information to the public and the agencies and the user groups and even visitors there that wanted to, you know, we got a lot of letters, oh, I want to hike the Iditarod, you know, well, that's not going to work, you know, type thing. So that's the coordinator was whatever came up that day, really, is what I did.
Were there permitting issues you were involved with?
Yes, I was. After the joint state federal trail office, we went strong for 2 years where I was located in state parks. That's by the end of 83 is when the Iron Dog race was proposed, and that was probably the biggest controversy that I had to deal with. The Snow Machine Club wanted to run a race for there, and just like we did every year on the Iditarod, we had to go through the environmental assessment and decide if the permitting was there. So I was the primary one working on that permit, and the Iditarod Trail Committee didn't want the snow machiners on their trail. And so that was a very interesting. There were a couple of court cases there that the one fellow, I forget his name, he didn't have standing and stuff. And we ended up issuing the permit, but that was after negotiation with changing the start date for the snow machine race from 2 weeks to 3 weeks after the Iditarod race, and modifying the race course a little bit and some other safety recommendations and stuff like that. And it went off without incident. And I was looking through an article a couple of days ago, and when the next one came up, the trail committee was saying, you know, that worked out pretty well, though. They're easy to work with and stuff. So, but it was an interesting period because both the two issues that kind of came up from different people. One was safety, and that's a very, very valid thing, and that's what we try to do as far as the spacing of the two things. And the other thing was a snow machine on a historic trail. Well, it was, yes, it's historic because snow machines are using it now. And so it wasn't just a snow machine, it was the race. So it was a lot of, there was a lot of motion in there. And one of the concessions from the Iron Dog people where they were calling, they took off Iditarod out of their name, and part of it was the identity of the trail committee and stuff, but they said, oh yeah, well, we'll change it to the Iron Dog race instead of the Iditarod snow machine race or whatever. And so, but anyway, that was, we got through that, and I'm not sure how many more years that they both are using that, but you know, we had, I did a bike, I did a ski, I Iron yep. Dog, and that, so a lot of different competitive events on there.
Well, and they're all still going on. And I was wondering if the I did a bike, I did a ski thing came up during your tenure.
It did. I think their first proposals were there, but it turned out they weren't where they were going. It wasn't on BLM land or whatever. There was never a permit issued there. I can't remember how that all came about, but we didn't entertain any permits for those things. And I think some of those early ones weren't for the whole Iditarod. It was just sort of like from around Kinnick up to Rainy Pass or in that stretch somewhere that they were trying that stuff. Maybe after I did a bike through the snow and they decided they didn't want to go to Nome. I don't know.
No, they still do. Some people only go as far as McGrath and other ones go all the way to Nome.
Well, that's kind of cool.
Well, yeah, these big fat tire bikes now. Well, yeah. They've been doing it long before those fat tire bikes. But it is an interesting question about the snow machines. Snow machines have been used in Alaska, in rural Alaska since, 1960-ish. Yeah. So is that historic?
Yeah. Yeah, and there's no requirement. I mean, when, part of the historic trail may be a little close to the, well, even like, say, the Oregon Trail. Part of the Oregon Trail is interstates now, and cars drive down it. Does that hurt the Oregon Trail? Probably not.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, but it's just there. So it's there's no requirement for use. I mean, these are rights of ways and paths that people have used. And because it's now a national trail, does that not allow them to do that? Well, we thought, no, that's not an issue. And it was sort of, like I said, more, it was the safety issue that was the concern in dealing with the permit. And I think we worked that out.
Yeah. Well, and it's not a non-motorized recreation trail. It's a historic trail, and those are different designations.
Right.
Do you remember I can't remember the guy's name either, who had the biggest concern in the court case, what his issues were?
Oh, I think it was Lafferty.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, Lafferty, as I recall. And it was just I don't remember. It was the issue of this is a historic trail and they shouldn't be doing. I don't remember that.
Yeah.
But as I recall, he didn't have standing and it was dismissed.
Yeah.
We had another court hearing, an administrative law judge for some, and it was an out thing, I don't quite remember, but basically a case was brought to him because of the race, but he basically said, well, BLM's not breaking the law, but on the other hand, they're not, they need to get their management plan done. Advisory council was in limbo and stuff. And I think in some ways that would really help us get back on finally finishing that plan and getting the advisory council reappointed. So it was, I mean, maybe all in the long run a good thing, because it may still be in limbo.
Yeah. The other thing I was going to say about snow machines is they make very good trail breakers.
Mm.
Maybe that's why the trail committee finally decided, oh, that's not so bad. They're breaking the trail for us.
Yeah, well, the thing is, their race was done, and they didn't have to worry about it for another year.
Oh, I see. Oh, it was, okay, the Iron Dog comes after the dog race.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, and that was their concern, especially when it was a 2 weeks that they were putting in articles about, well, it takes them 3 to 4 days to get to Nome, and it takes us as much as some of the early ones, almost a month or 2 weeks, and they had the thing, they're afraid of the racers in the snow machines catching up to the tail end of the lantern holders in the in the dog sled race.
And also I could see that the snow machines are going so fast that they'd make lots of washboardy on the trail.
Yeah,
which is very unpleasant on a dog sled.
Yeah, it is. So yeah, it was anyway, that, as far as in my dual role as, and that was my dual role at that time, I was working for the McGrath Resource Area, working on the permit, and also trail administrator, dealing with all these different people. But I was, like I said, it came out okay.
Yeah. So the other thing I was thinking about, the land ownership, conveyance, right-of-way stuff, that had to go on because BLM did not own all the land that the trail went across. Were you involved in any of that?
Well, not directly. As things, I mean, I did work with the BLM conveyance people and stuff. Now, a lot of these were easements that were already in place, again, before the designation or during or something like that. But I, like I say, when I was working with the state, they were anxious to get their trails locked in, and I worked with them a little bit, again, showing this is what we have, this is what we know, everything. We even came up with, we even came up with official markers.
Oh, right, with the logo.
With the logo, and we're, the idea was to have this square to show the trail, you know, the volunteer group doing it. And these did, some of these did go up in that part north of Kinnick, but we found out they became collector's items too quick. So, as I think the Iditarod Trail, got one of the Iditarod Trail signs too, you know.
Yeah, and, that's different.
Yeah, and that was what they were putting up prior to the National Trail, and then we came up with.
Oh, those yellow ones were the National Trail. Oh, I see. With the dog team, and yeah.
Yeah.
Slightly different logo. And then I see the yellow one has the trailblazer's name.
Yeah. And then we had some that were kind of blank, that is gnome or
okay.
The other, there we could put the identifier there. So that was the, became semi, well, was official logo and I guess the official trail marker too that we were trying to get out there. I doubt if any of those are out there anymore.
Well, there's, I haven't been out on the trail, so I don't know. There must be some markers so people know where to go.
Just design. I don't know. Yeah. Lost track of that.
I do know out of Nome, they have the tripods that they put up since they don't have trees to put those signs on.
Yeah.
But so with the easements and right-of-ways, how does that work? If the land is owned by a corporation or the state, a native corporation or the state, they are then going to transfer that land to BLM for the trail, or
they just put
a right-of-way?
It's an easement. Yeah, an easement or a right-of-way. Yeah, it's their land. It's just the public has a right to use it. Yeah, there's no, and there's never an intent of the BLM to start getting rights away for them to manage. I mean, that was never the concept, even in those early days. It's just a matter of identifying and getting the landowner and the documentation to allow that. And,
okay. And when, who did you report to in BLM? Did you have to get approval for these things you were doing as administrator?
Yeah, I worked, basically I've been probably the district manager of the time, and of Anchorage District was sort of that's sort of the chain of command there. So I basically had offices in two places, and I it wasn't like I abandoned the Bureau for 2 years. I was at the state. I worked there. And so I was still, even at that time, still doing a little bit of, you know, on both sides of the fence, management and administration there, because it just made sense. I was the only one there. There wasn't another person handling Iditarod on the ground stuff for the Bureau while I was at state parks.
Mm-hmm.
I was both, but I was housed at state parks.
But then you went back to the Anchorage field office, right?
Yeah. McGrath Resource Area, then up to the Anchorage District Office, yeah.
And so you had supervisors who approved your projects that you were working on?
I kept them informed what was going on, any issues that were coming up and stuff. There was nothing I initiated out of the blue to say, I got an idea, but it's just a matter of the information flow keeping everybody on board and keeping the public on board what was happening and stuff. But and a good example was back to that Iron Dog controversy and stuff like that. I was working with them, and I was still a Bureau employee. I was just assigned to state parks. It was, kind of a unique situation, but because state parks didn't have really any, I was going to say dog in the race, that, didn't have anything to say about that. But between the state parks director and the Anchorage district manager, and that was Dick Tindall and Dick Verneman and stuff. And then, you know, the state director, and also there was a briefing that got involved with the state director. So it's just, I like to let people know what I'm doing.
Right. Well, yeah, and I was wondering, like, that Iron Dog permit question, and eventually it had to be approved by somebody at BLM. It wasn't just you approving it. Somebody up the chain of command had to approve it, right?
I don't know if it was the area manager or the district manager. I think it was the area manager with approval from the district manager, but it was, yeah, it was my boss at that time through the Bureau.
Okay, yeah, it's lots of layers of bureaucracy that I don't know the chain of command there.
Yeah. So for me, from a guy just working, and you have your, where there's a division chief and a resource manager and a district manager and a state director and lots of people in between. Well, not lots of people in between, that's about it. But you're right, there's chain of command. And depending on how serious it is, I was kind of surprised, you know, a lot of letters I could sign myself to the public, and here's what I know. And then if it's any policy or issue, it was the managers would sign it, and I wouldn't. So, because I was not a manager in that respect.
Do you feel like you were given support within the BLM structure, or did they kind of just put you off on the side and, oh, the trail's a nuisance, we don't want to deal with it?
No, I think good support. I mean, at local, again, in Alaska, it's a good thing for Alaska and stuff. Now, I had good support in the Bureau, and it was just, the only support that didn't come is during tight budget times. You didn't get the money to maybe do some things you'd like to. You know, you go through a whole budgeting process, do your proposals that run up the chain to Washington, and then a year or so later, it comes down and says, well, here's what money you have to work with. Figure out what you can do, or they pretty much direct you what you can do, and it becomes obvious. And at that time, staffing, I think things were pretty tight, as I recall, and it's 40 years ago, but I think just getting people paid, staff and a little bit of travel was the goal for some of those years.
Do you have some examples of a project that you would put in funding for, you wanted to do, and then you weren't able to?
No, I can't think. I can't think of any. Again, it was for the 2 years after the planning. It was just trying to get the word out. And I think it was really, really good that the Bureau let me go over to state parks.
Right.
That cooperative thing. I think that was a real plus, because I think it gave everybody a shot in the arm to get things done. And
so at that time, you weren't overseeing projects like they do now, where they're building a public shelter cabin, or they're, you know, somebody's out there brushing out a certain section. You didn't have those kinds of projects.
No, that wasn't going on. I was trying to get the volunteer groups, the trailblazers, going for that and stuff. You know, that was... You know, the idea was definitely, the word was down, it's cooperative management. Now, who else can you bring into the cooperation and stuff? So, no, I didn't have any projects that I, you know, no pet projects. But I'm glad they do now. I mean, mm-hmm. It's just, they've done some really neat stuff that I've heard about.
Yeah, and it's definitely still cooperative. You say there's, like, those shelter cabins, BLM isn't going out and building them. They're, you know, the local group is working with BLM, and it's done cooperatively.
Well, you'll have to ask the trail minister. I'm not sure how it's done now, but no, I imagine it's the Bureau doing it with their help.
Yeah, it's exactly. It's still a cooperative thing, and the Iditarod Historic Trail Alliance as well. That it's this cooperative. Yeah. Between the Alliance and BLM and the local communities and the trail committee, and
Yeah.
It's still very much cooperative and use of volunteers out on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So did you spend any time out on the ground on parts of the trail?
I did during the various phases. I did go out with on some of the surveys, like out to Rhone River to look at some of the historic sites. And early on, we flew the length of the main part of the trail to land at a couple of the historic properties, and that was with Steve Peterson and stuff, who was doing his surveys and stuff. So I was able to do that. And then during, I usually at race time, I usually made it to the end of several of the races, and then as part of that, I would put on a little slideshow about the historic trail and stuff. So kind of the information, but no, I didn't have to do any brushing or or locating of trying. No, I didn't have time for that, and again, no money for that sort of thing at that time.
And you didn't go out and do your own personal snow machine or dog sled trip or ski trip out there?
No, I've been on dog sled and been on snow machine in the White Mountains and my other roles in the Bureau and stuff, but not on the Iditarod.
Okay, so that wasn't part of your job duties, other duties as assigned, go and play on the trail?
No.
You talked about one of the Iron Dog as one of the challenges. What would you consider some of your greatest successes or pleasures with working on the trail?
Well, I think that whole project planning effort with Kerry Brown and Steve and Bob Spoody and stuff, I think that was a really unique opportunity in the Bureau to get that done. And actually, though it took a while to get that final one done, to get the volume one and volume two out. And I think that's and the fact that it's still there, that's 40 years later, it's kind of amazing that it hadn't been updated, but maybe it's working just the way it's supposed to. I'm not sure, but I think that was a real success. And like I mentioned before, not so much on my efforts, but the fact that especially the Seward Trailblazers are so active and I kind of aware of what they're doing. I think that's a success as part of the trail effort, not necessarily my effort, but I think that's a success of the trail, that the volunteer group can be so active. And you got to hand it to Dan Seavey. He's just tireless and protecting that trail and making it, good for the public. And maybe I'm more aware of that because I get my newsletters on that from them there. So I can, it makes me feel good when I read what they're doing.
Well, that's good. Were there other challenges or obstacles you faced along the way?
I really can't think of any. No, it was just, if anything, it's just, budget, and so you got your budget and you did what you could with it. I mean, that's the Bureau way. You just get on, do what you can, I wasn't blocked from doing anything, just wasn't funded from doing different things and stuff. And the fact is, the final plan called for cooperative management, so my efforts were working with all the different agencies, and we worked with Fish and Wildlife Service and the Inoco and everything. So it's not that I call, or if they happen, I put them out of my mind after the years.
Yeah,
I don't think so. I think that that Iron Dog one was the one I thought, oh man, we're gonna have open warfare here between the sleds and the snow machines, but it didn't happen. And like I say, the second year, the Iditarod Trail Committee said, it worked out okay. And I think the year two, the 85 race went without a hitch too. And beyond that, I haven't kept track of it.
Well, and they're still doing the Iron Dog race, and they're still doing the dog sled race, so they must get along. I was thinking, do you feel like you your involvement helped smooth that out to make it happen to get that permit?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. I work, you know, try to work with both of them. And the trail committee at one point, we'll get along with them. And then they had a vote, and actually the vote was pretty close whether they should oppose the race or not. I found some old records that were given to me by the trail committee and their little protest against the race, and looking at some of their committee meetings, it was there that some people thought, you know, cooperation is the way to go on this, and it turned out that's what worked. But
yeah, it's interesting you say the dog mushers thought of it as their trail.
Yeah.
Were there challenges or problems working with the different agencies? I mean, you mentioned working with the state, but, you know, BLM, Park Service, Fish and Wildlife Service, they all have their own organizations and ways of doing things. Did it mesh together, or was that hard?
Well, I think it meshed, because, you know, everybody has their own mission, and they all had a piece of the trail, and it was just a matter of me, if an issue came up, me working with that agency to say, well, here's what this means. But in the long run, if it's on Forest Service land, it's their decision how to do that. But I can't ever remember any conflicts between the agencies. I think everybody worked good on that. When the final plan was finally done, the heads of the agencies all got together and got a copy, and all the big wigs sat around the table, and everybody got along. Yeah, so it was not, they were probably happy they didn't have to do the management plan.
Well, and the different agencies, as you say, have different missions, so they would have different priorities and different budgeting. I mean, maybe the trail was a priority for BLM, but it didn't mean Fish and Wildlife Service cared anything about the section. Did you have to deal with that?
I never came up. Never came up that it was a problem, no.
Okay.
No, I think everybody did what they could at the time with the money they had.
Right. And as you say, 40 years ago, it was a different time and a different phase in the trail. It was just getting it going versus now it's much more of a management situation.
Yeah. Yeah, it'd be interesting to interview the current trail administrators. I'll be interested to look and see what they're doing.
Yeah.
It'll be fun.
Yeah, I was going to say, if there's things that you wish could have been done on the trail that didn't happen during your time, or what you see for the future of the trail, I don't know if you can answer that you've been out of it for so long.
Yeah, I think it's a long time. As I mentioned earlier in the interview, I was just very proud to see all that information available online now that the public has, and even volume one and volume two is available. So you need to look at those, but the fact that that's survived, is really good. And I think that's a huge success that the Bureau and the subsequent trail managers have been able to pull that, and it's there. So it's there forever. And you know, the management issues change with times a bit and stuff, but there's always that base. Well, here's how it started, and here was the concept, and here's what we're trying to do. If here are the important sites and trail segments and historic records that are pulled together, the photograph and all the old historic maps and stuff. I think that the fact that that's one-stop shopping now is just incredible.
Well, and from a planner's perspective, A management plan that is now 40 years old, is that still useful, or should there be a new one done?
I would think so. I would think so, but not being in that seat anymore, I couldn't.
Well, it was sort of more of, not the specifics of this plan, but just in general, on plan from a planning perspective.
Yeah.
Using a 40-year-old plan, is that the most effective tool?
Well, it depends if it's working or not or stuff, but it would seem that from a planning standpoint, I think It should be revisited. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. So after you left the trail administrator job, that's when you went to Arizona, right?
No,
you did the McGrath thing.
Yeah, well, I was still trail administrator at McGrath and still at the Anchorage District. Then I went to the state program lead for recreation in Alaska.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
For about 3 years. And then I transferred down to Arizona. I was single parenting in those days. And I wanted to take my son down and get him closer to our moms. My mom was living then, and his mom was down in California. And I just wanted to get him closer down mm-hmm. there. So I got the job offer in Phoenix, and I just jumped at it.
As this Alaska statewide recreation trail person, did you continue to be involved with the Iditarod Trail at all?
At what point?
Well, after you left BLM, after you became the statewide person?
Dean Littlepage was the trail administrator okay. at that time. And we talked about different things. I think he was instrumental in getting one additional trail segment out of Iditarod or to the Yukon River added to this system. And we actually had the Secretary of Interior in Lujan in town, and he signed a document there. So helped get that set up and everything. I had quite a little bit of a ceremony. But no, I had lots of other issues to deal with there, but it was, you know, the baton had been passed, and Dean did a really good job of some new energy into that.
Okay, yeah, so you didn't have anything to do with it after you went statewide.
Well, okay. I did, you know, his issues would come down, but basically on the ground issues, if anything, I didn't make any decisions, but if something came down from a congressman's office, I'd ship it to Dean and I'd ship the response back and that sort of thing. But so I was aware, and it became one of many things that was I had to keep track of, but I wasn't active in managing or administrating at that point. Okay.
Well, it's interesting what you said about Congressman Young and Senators Stevens and Murkowski getting letters from the public and that influencing some of the decision-making.
All right, I think it did. Yeah, I think it did. I think it just was there. I think they, because that was a lot. That's Iditarod's magic word in Alaska, it raised the importance of getting that thing moved on. So it was the management plan and the advisory council was stalled at that point, and then that all of a sudden it enabled us to go to the next phase.
Do you know, was there a letter writing effort or campaign or?
No, I don't think so. I mean, just general. I'm not sure.
Okay. I could see Joe Reddington pushing for.
I could too. Joe is a wonderful person. I was the other nice thing about my time in Iditarod, the wonderful people I got to meet along the way. I mean, just from start to finish, from Seward to Nome, and everywhere in between, everybody involved, and everybody so passionate about the Iditarod. It was a very, very, very good, positive BLM job to have.
Well, you just answered my question was, what did this mean to you, having these years working on the Iditarod Trail? What has that meant to you?
I'll tell you what, I've had a wonderful career, you know, starting Forest Service and BLM Alaska and BLM Arizona and just, it's been great, but this is one of the high points, and I do kind of keep track of what's happening on that. But it's kind of a nice thing, and I'm even more excited about it since she asked me to prepare for this, and I had to dust off that file and dig out the signs and do a little timeline there, just kind of get things straight in my mind about all the things to do. And there's more of that coordination there that I forgot I was involved in, just at all different levels. Any any letter come to the Bureau or the state for a while on Iditarod, I'd have to respond to it and research it and get the information back that they were inquiring. And it was fun traveling around talking to the different groups, you know, different pioneers associations and brown bag lunches, and then all, it was great. It was a fun job.
Yeah, you were like the public information officer for the Iditarod Trail.
That was it, it was fun.
Did you produce any pamphlets or booklets during that time?
No, I didn't know. Because we had the plan, basically we had the plan in hand, and now we need to do that. But as far as going and doing any subsequent publications, you know, be press releases on different things and stuff, I'd work with our public affairs in Anchorage and stuff like that. But no, I didn't have time. After getting the draft to final during that period, that was enough writing for a while. That was the major. I heard that through the process,
right,
and stuff. So no, I didn't do anything during that period.
Yeah, I didn't know if, as part of this public education outreach, if there was any brochures or things put out for advertisements or whatever.
Pretty much on demand. On demand, and responded to inquiries and requests for appearances and stuff.
Okay. I know you've thought a lot about this and gone through the list of questions I kind of was proposing. Have we covered everything, or there's more things you want to talk about?
I think we covered the waterfront pretty well on that. I really enjoyed this this interview.
Good. Good. Well, I want to make sure we covered all the stuff that you wanted to talk about and your the memories this process has brought up for you.
Let me just look at my notes real quick, see if there's anything. Yeah, if anybody wants to contact me about timelines and stuff. No, I think that's, I think I pretty well covered it.
Okay.
It's been really nice. I really enjoyed this.
Well, great. Thank you so much for your time.